returning a lost toy the only reason you called me?
Nope, Jack said. I was hoping you might know a good place to eat.
Ah, you are wise, Jack Ryan. If there's one thing I love more than cowboys, it's food. First, I will make a call about the woman. Then we will have a dinner you will never forget.
Great, Jack said. But just so you know, cowboys don't eat hummus.
Then it's a good thing you are not a cowboy.
Chapter 12.
30 minutes and a series of hair-raising lane changes later, they were seated at a quiet table overlooking the Mediterranean. A warm ocean breeze was rolling off the water, bringing with it the smells of salt water and grilling meat. The air tugged at Tal's blonde-streaked hair with invisible fingers, tousling her thick curls. Jack expected her to pull her hair back with one of the endless rubber bands or hair clips women always seem to carry, but the shin bet officer surprised him once again. Turning her face into the breeze, Tal closed her eyes and breathed deeply.
I love the ocean, she said.
I thought you loved cowboys, Jack said.
I love a great many things, Jack Ryan.
Ah, food. The waiter had appeared as they'd sat down, but Tal had sent him scurrying away with a long burst of Hebrew before he'd even had a chance to speak. Jack had tried to add in a request or two of his own, but the Shin Bet officer overruled him. She'd stated in unequivocal terms that since Jack was a guest in her country, he would eat and drink what she ordered. Jack had protested, but more because he thought Tal expected it than because of any real sense of disappointment. In truth, he enjoyed just about everything. Besides, he liked tweaking the Israeli Spitfire.
The waiter deposited the first course on the table with a flourish that would have won awards at a 5-star restaurant. 6 bowls of hummus, each garnished with fresh olives, along with a basket of warm pita bread. Next came glasses of wine, as well as bottles of beer and sparkling water. Not a bad start to the evening. Jack wanted to pretend that the hummus starter annoyed him, but the bread smelled too good. Ripping a slice in two, he dunked the warm pita in the first available bowl and took a heaping mouthful.
Heaven. You like it?
Tal said, eyes sparkling.
Love it, Jack said, going back for a second helping. As long as we both understand that hummus alone is not a proper meal.
Tal opened her mouth to reply when the shrill ring of her phone interrupted. Fishing into her purse, she retrieved the handset.
Hello? Tal said, holding the phone to her ear.
Jack could hear a male voice on the other end, but the Hebrew words were indecipherable. Tal nodded twice, asked a single question, and then ended the call after receiving the answer.
That was the office, Tal said, dropping the handset back into her purse. We have an address for your friend.
That was fast, Jack said, tearing off another chunk of pita.
We are the Shin Bet. Fast is what we do.
Jack started to speak, but forgot what he was going to say. A white contrail streaked into the blue Mediterranean sky just behind Tal's right shoulder.
Rocket, Jack said, rising to his feet.
Tal spun in her chair, saw the smoke trail, and cursed.
It's coming from Gaza.
What now? Jack said.
Now you get a first-hand demonstration of Israeli technology.
The Iron Dome? Jack said.
Tal nodded. Although the system does have limitations, namely cost. Each interceptor has a price tag of more than $40,000, so unless the rocket's trajectory shows that it's going to hit a populated area, the computer controlling the interceptors will not trigger a launch. An air raid siren underscored Tal's words. The warbling sound made Jack feel as if he were on set in a World War II movie rather than in present-day Tel Aviv. But his fellow diners didn't seem overly concerned by the warning.
Don't take this the wrong way, Jack said as the contrail continued to climb. But shouldn't we be heading to a bunker or something?
What?
And miss the show? Tal said. Her smile was just as bright, but to Jack's eye, seemed a bit fixed. 5 years ago, maybe even two, everyone would be running for shelter. But I'm afraid the Iron Dome has made us complacent. The interceptor's effectiveness means that rocket attacks are down. When the jihadis do launch, they send the projectiles up in waves in the hopes of overwhelming the system. A single rocket is nothing to worry about.
It will be if it hits near us, Jack said.
Watch and learn, Jack Ryan. The contrail reached its zenith and then started arcing back toward Earth. A rocket scientist, Jack was not, but it didn't take a physicist to see that the white finger was pointing right at them.
It must be an optical illusion, Tal said, echoing his thoughts.
If we were in danger, an interceptor would have launched by now. Jack was about to make the case about discretion being the better part of valor when a streak of fire rose from the skyline behind them.
Better late than never, Jack said, watching as the Tamir interceptor surged skyward at better than Mach 2.5.
Relax, Tal said,
the first bit of worry coloring her voice.
You're about to see something amazing.
She was right, but probably not in the way that she meant. The incoming rocket's contrail did do something both amazing and awful. It changed course.
That thing's guided, Jack said, reaching across the table to grab Tal's hand.
We need to seek cover, now.
There's no need, Tal said, shaking her head. I told you.
Jack was done arguing. While Tal looked heavenward, Jack grabbed her by the waist and lifted her from her chair.
Hey, Tal said, squirming away. I said...
But whatever it was she intended to say, Jack didn't hear it. Probably because he'd slung the Shin Bet officer over his shoulder in a modified fireman's carry. But that was only part of the reason. Even if Tal had been able to talk with one of Jack's broad shoulders digging into her diaphragm, he probably wouldn't have heard her over a peculiar buzzing that sounded equally like ripping paper and hissing cat. In other words, the acoustic signature of a missile on terminal approach. Jack risked a glance skyward as he made for the relative shelter of a parked car. What he saw wasn't good. The white smoke trail was now angled straight toward them. The Iron Dome interceptor, on the other hand, seemed to be on a one-way trip to the moon. As the buzzing became a full-fledged roar, Jack dumped Tal against the vehicle and covered the slight woman's body with his own. A second later, the missile impacted.
Chapter 13. One moment, Jack's face was inches from Tal's flashing brown eyes. The next, he and the Israel intelligence officer were a jumble of intertwined limbs. Jack had a split second to think about how nice her muscular body felt against his chest. Then she jabbed him in the solar plexus and expertly slid from beneath him as he tried to catch his breath. Jack knew his spunky mother had made his father work for her hand, but even the indomitable Kathy Ryan hadn't spearheaded her future husband. Maybe he ought to listen to his mom and settle down with a nice Catholic girl after all. Assuming, of course, he made it out of Israel alive.
You're welcome, Jack said, rolling to his knees. Tal was already on her feet, surveying the scene over the hood of the car.
We should be dead, Tal said.
Like I said, Jack said, getting to his feet, you're welcome.
Yes, yes, Tal said, waving away his words with slender fingers. You were right about the rocket, but the blast radius was much too small. To reach Tel Aviv from Gaza, the terrorists would have used a locally made M-75 rocket, or perhaps an Iranian Fajr. These munitions have 10-kilogram high-explosive warheads. We should have felt the shockwave from here.
Jack stood, turned to survey the devastation, and realized Tal had a point. The rocket had impacted next to a kiosk selling newspapers and tourist knickknacks about 20 meters away.
While the air was filled with a blizzard of torn newspaper and the kiosk's metal frame leaned at an oblique angle, the structure was still largely intact. Even more surprising, the two cars parked on the street catty-cornered to the newspaper stand were both untouched. As Jack watched, an Arab man stumbled out of the kiosk and immediately sank to his knees. Tal ran toward him and Jack followed, but their help wasn't needed. The man was shaken, and perhaps even concussed, but he wasn't even bloody. A moment later, Jack realized that the man was on his knees because he was praying, not due to injuries. All things considered, Jack thought the shopkeeper might be onto something. "Do you see the rocket?" Jack asked. "Maybe it didn't detonate." Tal shook her head as she slowly walked around the kiosk. "Wait," Tal said, stopping on the far side of the structure. "I see it. The fins sticking up from the roof. Get everyone back." The Shin Bet officer pulled out her phone as she spoke and punched in a number. Jack jerked the Arab man to his feet and then shouted at the crowd of onlookers to move back. To his surprise, they listened. Though a handful of people wanted to congregate near the kiosk, the majority of the crowd was clumping together across the street, a safe distance away. At least Jack assumed the 100 or so feet constituted a safe distance. Rocket warheads weren't exactly his specialty. Fortunately, two police cars rolled up, and the uniformed men set up an honest perimeter. Relieved that his brief career in crowd control was over, Jack turned back toward the kiosk, searching for Tal. A moment later, he saw the diminutive brunette on the far side of the street, speaking with yet another police officer. Edging around the Israelis in front of him, Jack eased out of the crowd toward Tal. One of the policemen intercepted him. Though Jack had about 6 inches and probably close to 100 pounds on the officer, the Israeli showed no intention of backing down. Bowing up to Jack, the officer planted a hand on his chest and pushed him back, all the while yammering at him in Hebrew. With a potentially live rocket still sprouting from the kiosk, Jack figured that this wasn't the time to argue. "Tal!" Jack shouted, ignoring the fireball in front of him. "Tal!" The second time she heard her name, the Shin Bet officer turned. Seeing Jack, she ended her conversation and started toward him. She made it 2 steps before the rocket detonated. Chapter 14. Once again, Jack found himself in a tangle of limbs with an Israeli. This time, the Hebrew speaker was decidedly male and smelled of stale coffee and cigarettes. In other words, the sensation wasn't nearly as pleasant. Jack slid from beneath the police officer and struggled to his feet, and that was when he realized that things had gone from bad to worse in a blink of an eye. As familiar as he now was with the average Israeli's lively personality, Jack should have been on the receiving end of a torrent of Hebrew, or more likely, a less endearing form of Tal's spear hand to his solar plexus. Instead, the policeman was positively compliant. Because he was dead. A 6-inch chunk of steel protruded from the center of the man's back. At first, Jack went into triage mode, assessing the policeman's airway and breathing on his way to feeling for a pulse. But he was operating on autopilot. One look at the man's sightless eyes, and Jack knew his efforts were in vain. Like a marksman's crossbow bolt, the chunk of steel had entered the Israeli's body almost directly between the shoulder blades, snapping the spine in two before plunging through the chest cavity. No amount of battlefield trauma medicine could save a casualty who no longer had functioning lungs. Jack turned to survey the blast radius and swore. He'd certainly seen his fair share of death, but this was different. The pavement was slick with blood and strewn with body parts, while the kiosk was a smoldering pile of rubble. In that moment, Jack realized that the jihadis who'd launched the instrument of death had just sunk their equivalent of a hole in one. Short of detonating in a crowded movie theater, Jack couldn't think of a more lucrative target. The aluminum from which the flimsy structure had been constructed had sheared into millions of razor-sharp, lightweight projectiles, scattered in all directions by the shockwave like paper borne on a tornado. Jack's eyes raced from crumpled form to crumpled form until he saw a mop of sun-streaked brown hair puddled on the concrete. Sprinting across the street, he dropped to his knees next to the face-down Shin Bet operative and cursed again. Her blood-darkened hair suggested that Tal had also been caught in the explosion's kill zone. Steeling himself, Jack eased Tal onto her back. The unseen hands that had guided the killing steel into the policeman's chest cavity had seemingly pushed the same instruments of death away from Tal. Though her face was smeared with blood, most of it didn't seem to belong to her. Jack's probing fingers found a couple of superficial cuts, probably from flying glass and other debris, but nothing serious. "Tal, can you hear me?" Jack said. The Shin Bet officer's eyelids fluttered, and she let out a low moan, followed by a barely audible scream of Hebrew. "Tal," Jack said, stroking her cheek. Her eyes fluttered open, and then she convulsed. This time Jack was ready. He batted the spear hand away before Tal's hardened fingers found something soft. The woman must be hell to wake up next to. "Tal," Jack said, cupping her chin. "It's me, Jack." Tal's liquid eyes swam into his, and Jack found himself reassessing his earlier conclusion. Maybe this wouldn't be such a bad way to start the morning after all. "Jack," Tal said, dragging out his name. She wasn't exactly slurring her words, but the blast wave had clearly rung her bell. Explosively generated shockwaves were tricky things. The concussive force they generated increased exponentially the closer one stood to their epicenter. Oftentimes, the damage blast waves inflicted on the soft tissue of a person's internal organs were difficult to diagnose without an MRI. "I'm here," Jack said, shifting Tal so that he could cradle her head in his lap. "Can you hear me?"
"Everything hurts," Tal said,
her eyes sliding closed. "Uh-uh," Jack said, lightly slapping her cheek. "You've got to stay awake. I think you've got a concussion." Sirens screamed from every direction as emergency vehicles arrived, first responders leaping from the trucks before they'd fully stopped moving. In its short history, the nation of Israel had become adept at a good many things. Some of those things, like the innovation that powered Tel Aviv, were sources of national pride. Others sprang from national necessity. Responding to mass casualty events fell into the latter category. But in this case, the plethora of white-clad men and women absolved Jack of some of the guilt he felt for attending to the slumped Shin Bet officer, while potentially more seriously injured casualties lay within reach. The feeling of the Israeli lying in his arms and the smell of her coconut-scented brown skin aside, the danger of Tal slipping into a coma was a real concern. Jack needed to keep the Shin Bet officer talking until she was triaged by a medical professional.
"Jack,"
Tal said again. "Right here," Jack said. Her pronunciation sounded better, but he shaded her eyes to check dilation just in case. Her pupils dutifully expanded and contracted. So far, so good.
"Don't take this the wrong way," Tal said. "But you're a lousy dinner date."
Chapter 15. Darian surveyed the explosion's aftermath from his vantage point across the street. There was some irony to the fact that he'd been close enough to the explosion to be cut by flying glass, but it couldn't be helped. He'd mitigated the situation as best he could, choosing a restaurant with table-high concrete barriers and an overhead cover of thick Jerusalem limestone.
But concrete and barriers hadn't shielded him from the Arab rocket's poorly designed guidance system. No matter. The operational margins were razor thin, the tightest timelines Darian had ever tried to maintain in his not insignificant career. Before Darian's superiors authorized the second phase, they wanted to be damned sure the reward was going to be worth the inevitable price. Someone needed to verify that the software functioned correctly. That someone was Darian. Even so, his vantage point had been a little closer to the action than even he'd anticipated. As par for the course, the rocket had strayed from its intended trajectory. Significantly. The eggheads back in Tehran had assured Darian that the computed point of impact would bring the projectile no closer than 250 meters from his chosen vantage point. Which was interesting, since the rocket had crashed into a kiosk scarcely 25 meters away. Fortunately, while he'd acquiesced to General Ahmadi's demand that he document the Iron Dome interceptor's flight path from directly beneath what should have been the intercept point, Darian had held firm to his stipulation of a delayed action fuse. This precaution had provided Darian with the time necessary to duck behind a brick wall before the warhead detonated. Not so for the Jews who'd tried to help the stunned Arab to safety. But the destruction caused by the rocket was an afterthought. The important thing, the reason why Darian had put himself in harm's way to begin with, was the 4 seconds of video he'd shot with his cell phone's camera. Selecting the correct file, Darian posted it to YouTube, where it joined a dozen others. But the YouTube channel Darian had selected featured one important subscriber the rest of the videos making their way to the internet did not. Standing, Darian joined the throng of patrons moving away from the gore-filled streets and cries of the wounded. As Darian fell in with the crowd, his phone vibrated. Consulting the device, he activated the modified Telegram app and keyed in his encryption. A single word awaited. Approved. With a smile, Darian pocketed the phone. The real fun was about to begin. Chapter 16. Al-Tanf Outpost, Syria. "Surfer, this is Reaper 7," Kerry said. "If you can hear me, scratch your ear." Kerry watched through his optic as Jad brought a hand up to his right ear and gave it a scratch. Then, with his fingers safely hidden behind his mound of curly black hair, he turned the scratch into a one-fingered salute. "I think he hears us." The comment came from Doug Crum, and the sound of the team medic's voice made Kerry uneasy. Not because of anything old Crum Dog had said. The fast-talking Ohio boy had been on the team for almost 10 years, and as far as Kerry was concerned, there was no finer medic the world over. No. What made Kerry uneasy was that it should have been Jad's voice, not Doug's, that he heard just inches from his left elbow. But Jad was 1,000 meters away, entering a compound full of people who wanted to bring about the end of the world in the company of a CIA asset who might or might not be completely full of shit. Other than that, Kerry had nothing to worry about. "He's gonna be fine. You'll see." Kerry grunted, but didn't speak. The fact that Doug was trying to reassure him instead of busting his balls about Ohio State football was telling enough. If the indomitable Crumb Dog was worried, this whole operation was a bad fucking idea. Unfortunately, the time for second-guessing had long since come and gone. For better or worse, Jad was in the mix. "All elements, this is Reaper 7," Kerry said. "Surfer is Cruz. I say again, Cruz." Radio transmissions during operations were always tricky. Listening for and responding to long, detailed instructions took the operators' minds off what they were really supposed to be concentrating on, the battlefield. To that end, simple status updates were usually done via brevity codes, one-word call signs designed to let everyone on the radio net know exactly what was happening with as little chatter as possible. In an operation in which multiple brevity words would be transmitted over a period of time, they often had a theme. In this case, that theme was Carrie's favorite actors. Cruz meant that Jad had successfully entered the compound. Reeves was the next brevity code the team was listening for, indicating that Jad was through security. By the same token, Kidman was the one word everyone had memorized and no one wanted to hear. If that one came across the radio, the mission had gone to shit. Reaper 6 confirms, Cruz. The sound of Captain Alex Brown's voice echoing the brevity code did much to untangle the knots in Carrie's stomach. Doctrinally, the team leader should be in Carrie's position, on a hilltop with eyes on Jad as he rode shotgun in a Toyota truck. But once again, Alex had proved why he was uniquely suited to be a Special Forces A-team leader. Alex knew that what Jad was doing, while necessary, also upset the interpersonal dynamics that were so crucial to the team of 12 men whose lives depended on one another. Accordingly, he'd asked his team sergeant how he could best help, rather than dictating his role in the operation. After a moment of thought, Carrie had answered truthfully that the rear security position would be the best place. From there, Alex could concentrate on coordinating with the team's external assets and running interference between the men on the ground and their supervisors, sitting in an air-conditioned TOC 30 miles away from the action. Alex had readily agreed. Now the sound of his team leader's voice reminded Carrie that Jad wasn't alone. Less than a kilometer away, Alex was watching out for the entire team with all the force multipliers unique to a special operations element. As Al-Qaeda and the Taliban had learned the hard way in the months following 9/11, an A-team brought a considerable arsenal to the fight. Reaper 7, Reaper 14, Surfer's truck is pulling over. 14, this is 7, roger that. We knew this was going to happen. Stay frosty. As expected of an operational detachment Alpha Team sergeant, Carrie relayed his instructions in the calm, no-nonsense radio voice he'd spent his entire career cultivating. Soldiers keyed off the emotions of their leaders, and there was nothing that sent a tactical unit into a high hover like a leader losing his shit over the radio. But inside, Carrie felt anything but calm. Bill, the numbnuts CIA case officer who'd foisted this mission on Carrie's team, had assured Alex that Jad would have no problems with the compound's security. According to his asset, the cultists had a big construction project in the works on the southeast side of the facility. To keep the work going, the crazies had been paying locals to truck in raw materials, like sacks of quick-drying concrete, cinder blocks, lumber, and other odds and ends. The asset had been bringing in supplies once a day for the last week, always with a different laborer. Jad would fill in as his hired hand and use the opportunity to clandestinely take pictures as well as eyeball whatever the cultists were doing. Hopefully, General Ahmadi would make another appearance. But even if the Quds Force commander didn't show, Jad should be able to sniff out what the crazies had up their sleeves. Simple. Or at least it had seemed that way in the team room 8 hours prior. Now, as two men armed with AK-47s motioned for Jad to get out of the car, nothing about this operation seemed simple. Reaper 7, 14, Surfer is out of the car. The two military-aged males are both keyed on him. Reaper 7 copies all, Carrie said. I designate the MAM with the blue shirt as target Sierra 1. His partner is Sierra 2. Confirm, over. Reaper 14 as Sierra 1. Reaper 11 as Sierra 2. Reaper 7, roger. Surfer's duress signal, his hands interlaced on top of his head. You see that? Drop your target. Otherwise, I clear all fires. Surfer's a smooth operator. He's got this. Carrie's radio transmission was answered by multiple Rogers. Cool and calm. That was the name of the game. Even though his own fingers itched to be holding the stock of his Barrett advanced sniper rifle. It's not that he doubted the abilities of the team's other two snipers. Far from it. But Jad was his spotter, and it felt wrong that Carrie wasn't the one holding a bead on the head of one of the two men threatening his friend. But this is what it meant to be the team sergeant, instead of just another shooter. Everything's gonna be fine. Everything's gonna be fine, Doug said, whispering the mantra over and over like he was praying the rosary. For Christ's sake, Crumdog, Carrie said, adjusting the focus on his variable power scope. You're putting knots in my stomach. Knock that shit off. Sorry, boss, Doug said. It's Jad down there. It's fucking Jad. Carrie opened his mouth, but the snappy comeback he had planned turned to dust on his tongue. Carrie watched through the precision offered by his Horus reticle as Sierra One grabbed Jad by the shirt, chattering at him in Arabic. At the same time, Sierra Two pointed his AK-47 at the asset and motioned him out of the truck. Like all Green Berets, Carrie had spent 26 weeks at the conclusion of the Special Forces qualification course, learning a language that would be beneficial to his new life. Since he was being assigned to the 5th Special Forces Group, Carrie had been taught Arabic. While he was by no means fluent, he was picking up enough of the conversation through Jad's mic to understand that the guards were not happy about something. And that was a problem. An even bigger problem was the fact that Sierra One's fingers were inches away from the listening device concealed in Jad's shirt. Surfer's hands are still free, Carrie said, and he has not given the duress signal. I say again, he has not given the duress signal. Shooters are weapons hold. Acknowledge. Reaper 14, Roger. Reaper 11, Roger. The sniper's rapid acknowledgement was a good sign, but Carrie wasn't fooled. The psychological profile used to screen potential Green Berets was heavy on independent thought and action, as fitting for operatives who lived and worked far from the flagpole. But this independence came at a price. Carrie didn't doubt for a moment that if one of the shooters thought the situation was getting out of hand, he would fire. Carrie would do the same thing in their shoes. Reaper 7, this is Reaper 6, over. Go for 7, Carrie said. Roger 7, our TERP is providing a real-time translation. Those two knuckleheads are pissed about the quality of wood the asset trucked in yesterday. A bunch of the boards were warped. The TERP thinks this is just a negotiating technique. Over. Roger that, 6, Carrie said. It had better be. If the asset fucks this up because he's trying to skim some off the top by selling the crazies shitty wood, I will hold Bill, Bob, or whatever the fuck his name is, personally responsible. Understood, 7, Alex said. And since Bill is standing right next to me, I think he's tracking too. His team leader's words brought a smile to Carrie's face, and he felt some of the tension leave his body. On the screen, the harsh body language and angry tones had de-escalated into something that more resembled everyday bargaining at the bazaar than an encounter that would lead to death. After a final tongue-lashing, both Jad and the asset were allowed back in the truck and waved toward the construction site. Carrie released the breath he hadn't realized he'd been holding in a noisy rush of air. Beside him, Doug's whispers faded to silence. The radio was still active as the 8 other members of the team monitored Jad's progress across the compound from their respective observation posts. While Carrie had chosen the rock outcropping where he and Doug were hidden for the view it offered of the compound's interior, it still didn't provide a completely unobstructed sightline. At several points, obstacles obscured the truck, and Carrie had to chart Jad's position via brevity words called out by his fellow Green Berets. Then came the one he'd been waiting for. "Surfer is Garner. I say again, Jennifer Garner." Carey acknowledged the radio call with two clicks of his transmit button while fiddling with the display, dividing it in half as he selected a second video source. This imagery came courtesy of a tiny wireless button camera on Jad's shirt. 2 days ago, the cult members had erected a set of tents covering the construction site, and Bill, the CIA officer, didn't think it was to shade the workers. For once, Carey agreed. The cultists might be crazy, but that didn't mean they were dumb. Chances were those tarps were protecting something important from prying eyes in the form of orbiting satellites or loitering drones. Jad was about to put this theory to the test. Carey waited as the staticky video resolved into recognizable images, as the digital amplifier situated with Reaper 11 decoded the video stream and boosted the signal. All at once, a series of symmetrical indentations roughed into the soil and framed by lengths of wood swam into view. The shaky video showed plots laid out in a grid that spanned a 100-meter footprint, with each indentation equidistant from its neighbor. The depressions were too small to serve as building foundations. But Carey had done enough construction work on the family farm to recognize a rough-in for concrete when he saw one. "What the hell are those?" Doug said, pointing at the screen. "Don't know," Carey said, "but I have a feeling we're going to find out." Chapter 17. Tel Aviv, Israel. Darian studied himself in the mirror, checking the results of his transformation. While his jovial face remained, little else of Jonathan Mills was present. The unruly blonde curls were absent, and so were the blue eyes, and about 2 inches of height. Jonathan had gone the way of a multitude of other aliases Darian had employed in his long and storied career. The wig and contact lenses were in a trash bag at his feet, along with the specially designed platform shoes. But most important, the carefree bohemian personality that accompanied them was also banished to the dustbin of Darian's operational mind. In their place was the man currently staring back at him from the mirror. While Jonathan's carefree locks had grabbed and held the eye, the muddy brown hair parted to the left side of his head with a surgeon's precision didn't attract attention. Or at least not the same kind Jonathan would have relished. No, the no-nonsense haircut paired with dark eyes and conservative yet expensive linen slacks and a button-down shirt worn open at the neck spoke of something else. Precision matched with maturity. A professional's wardrobe. But not just any professional. A venture capitalist. Darian studied his appearance, looking at the apparition not as an extension of himself, but as a projection of who he wanted the world to see. The handsome, accomplished man staring back at him looked the part. Almost. Something was missing. Something hard to articulate, but necessary all the same. Gravitas. A VC manager successful enough to fly halfway around the world in search of new ideas to invest in needed to look the part. Eyeing the open box resting on the counter to his left, Darian selected a bottle, opened it, and dabbed the contents on a fine bristled brush. Next, he stroked the liquid through his sideburns and temples with an artist's precision. After 5 or 6 strokes, he again consulted his reflection. This time, he nodded. The patches of gray conveyed exactly the right message. The man standing before him was still in his prime, but had earned his exalted reputation by burning the midnight oil. As the salt and pepper hair attested, his professional success, while merited, had not come easy. This was a man who had endured the jealousy of his contemporaries, while succeeding where they had not. In short, a man uncannily like the woman he was scheduled to meet. Darian clenched and unclenched his fists, trying to burn off the adrenaline still coursing through him. Contrary to spy novels, the vast majority of an espionage practitioner's life was spent in boredom. Crash meetings with excitable assets were part of the game, but these instances were the exception rather than the rule. Wet work was even rarer. A good spy swam through the sea of humanity without notice, just another unremarkable fish among an ocean of many. Dead bodies, on the other hand, had the opposite effect. Darian had certainly been involved in his share of assassinations, but these operations were meticulously planned and executed only when there truly were no other options. And once the deed was done, the operations team was spirited out of country before their victim's body had begun to cool. Usually. But this operation was different, and in Darian's experience, different was not good. He'd once heard it said that there were bold pilots and old pilots, but no old bold pilots. This was doubly true for those who practiced the art of espionage. And yet, here he was, preparing for another high-risk operation in the same country where he'd broken an asset's wrist, killed two Israeli police officers, and watched a missile impact just 25 meters away. Each of these heat state increasing actions had been conducted in Israel, the most dangerous adversary his country had ever known. A nation that had crafted a national strategy around the notion of striking first and asking questions later. Was the risk posed by the final phase of this operation truly worth the reward? Darian took a deep breath, let it out, and gazed at his reflection, knowing the answer. This was the operational opportunity of a lifetime. Even if what happened next burned him so badly that he would never be able to leave Iran again, it would be worth it. In one fell swoop, Darian would bring Israel to its knees while stripping America of the technological invincibility it had enjoyed for far too long. This was the reason why he'd joined the Ministry of Intelligence to begin with. When this operation was successful, Darian would return home a hero, if he was willing to do what was necessary. And that was the question. Was he willing to risk everything? As Darian's father had told him since he was old enough to understand, this was the purpose for which he'd been created, the reason why he'd been granted his mother's American face and tongue, and his father's Persian soul and courage. This unique combination was a gift that would someday allow him to operate where his fellow countrymen feared to tread, Israel. And not only that, Darian possessed the means to finally accomplish what the politicians and mullahs had been promising since the Islamic Republic of Iran's founding more than four decades ago. Until this moment, their promises to push Israel into the sea had been nothing but empty words. Not anymore. Darian had the chance to make good on the threats uttered by untold lips. Where Arab and Persian alike had failed, where the Nazis had stumbled, Darian could right the historical wrong forced upon the Middle East at the conclusion of World War II. If he were successful, the Quds Day holiday would finally be a day of joy and truth instead of just the pretend world his countrymen inhabited. Darian would be the one to transform a nation's tears into laughter while ushering in a new alliance that would permanently check the influence of the United States and her lapdogs. The day of reckoning was finally here. Nodding at his reflection, Darian snapped the makeup bag closed. He was ready. Chapter 18.
Jack stepped into the lobby of the Hilton Tel Aviv and paused, impressed with the view in spite of himself. With more hours on international flights than most commuters at miles, Jack had seen his fair share of foreign locales and luxury hotels. Accordingly, he'd learned long ago to avoid tourist destinations in favor of living like the locals. He rarely stayed in hotels, and when he did, he purposefully chose ones that didn't cater to Westerners. The Hilton was the opposite of this philosophy. First opened for business in 1965, the establishment was constructed primarily with foreign tourists in mind. With easy access to the Hilton Beach, shuttles running to and from Ben Gurion Airport, staff who spoke impeccable English, daily tours of Israel's stunning list of attractions, and restaurants that served both Western and Mediterranean cuisine, the hotel had a reputation as a one-stop shop for travelers who appreciated a little hand-holding. In other words, the perfect spot for an American mother and her special needs child. In spite of the hotel's sterling reputation and its commanding view of the Mediterranean from a prime stretch of real estate on Hilton Beach, Jack had come to Tel Aviv with about as much intention of visiting the hotel as he had of frequenting the McDonald's located 2 kilometers south. This wasn't to say that Jack was some sort of foodie snob, but he did believe that when in Rome, do as the Romans. With this in mind, he was certain he'd dislike the hotel the moment he strode into the lobby. He was wrong. The lobby was breathtaking. The entire space was designed to showcase the view through the floor-to-ceiling windows making up the far wall. The blue Mediterranean sparkled invitingly through the glass, and once again Jack felt a yearning for the feeling of a surfboard between his legs as he sat bobbing in the warm water. The customary check-in desks loomed to his left, with a concierge's stand to his right. But rather than the ritzy, out-of-place feeling most high-end hotels generated, the Hilton's lobby did nothing to try to detract from the beckoning ocean. Jack wasn't a student of architecture, but even he could see that this space was something magical. As if the hotel's builders had been trying to communicate that the real jewel of Tel Aviv was just outside the hotel's steel doors. Therefore, any time spent inside the hotel should be both pleasant and brief. Jack could sympathize. Snapping out of his reverie, Jack looked at the check-in clerk's and concierge desk, weighing his options. After attempting to follow Tal to the hospital, her partner had let Jack know in no uncertain terms that his presence wasn't wanted. Rather than go head-to-head with the Shin Bet goon, Jack had decided to search for Tommy and his mother on his own. He'd come to the hotel on a hunch. Getting into their quarry's head was a skill set honed by all good intelligence officers. Jack didn't know where Tommy and his mother were staying, and normally that wouldn't be a problem. A single call to Gavin Beery, the campus's hacker extraordinaire, and Jack would know everything about the mystery woman in minutes. From there, it would be child's play to determine where she and her son were staying. But Jack was hesitant to make use of the campus's resources normally at his disposal. Tal had been unflinching in her assessment of Jack and the attention his presence on Israeli soil was drawing. His phone was compromised, and though he hadn't spotted a tail, Jack had to believe he was a target of surveillance, electronic or otherwise. Unlike the softer, gentler Western services, Israel's two premier intelligence organizations, Shin Bet and Mossad, thwarted attacks intent on maiming or killing Israeli citizens daily. As Israeli politicians patiently explained to the rest of the world time and time again, Israel was a nation surrounded by enemies. In the world's only Jewish state, threats weren't abstract or launched from a nation thousands of miles away. No. In Israel, terrorist cells formed,
planned and tried to execute bombings from enclaves in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip, literally a stone's throw from their Jewish targets. With this in mind, the intelligence services charged with protecting the nation of Israel and her people didn't bother with the niceties common to their Western counterparts. The Mossad and Shin Bet played for keeps. As such, Jack was operating under the assumption that he was completely burned, which in turn meant that every and all communication between himself and the outside world was being monitored. He had no intention of further confirming or denying Tal's suspicions by letting the Shin Bet listen in on his call to Gavin. For the remainder of Jack's time on Israeli soil, the campus didn't exist. But by no means was Jack helpless. He'd been trained by the best in the business and served alongside legends. It was time to put that training and experience to work. After a moment more of thought, Jack headed for the concierge's desk. The man behind the desk was tall and thin, with the build of a marathoner. Even so, in yet another mark of a great hotel, his suit fit his frame perfectly. He smiled as Jack approached, asking, "Can I help you?" in flawless English. "I hope so," Jack said, reaching into his pocket. "By the way, your English is excellent. Were you raised in America?" "No, sir," the concierge said with another smile. "My mother was an English teacher. She practiced her lessons at home, and my sister and I were her willing and sometimes unwilling pupils." "I feel your pain," Jack said with a laugh. "My father was a history professor. While most families talked sports around the dinner table, we discussed Alexander the Great. Anyway, I could use your help." Jack withdrew the Captain America figure from his pocket and set it atop the concierge's desk. "I met a mother and her child briefly in the marketplace a couple hours ago. She's American with brown hair, about 5'5" with a trim build. Probably in her 30s. I'd guess her son is about 7 or 8. He was wearing a baseball cap and shorts, and he dropped this. I was hoping to return it." As Jack spoke, the man's smile slowly vanished, his lips compressing into a hard line. "I'm sorry, sir," the concierge said, "but for security reasons, we can't discuss our guests. I hope you understand." "I understand completely," Jack said, "and I apologize for not being clear. The child is special needs, probably autistic. Growing up, I had a friend with the same condition. This toy looks cheap, but based on my experience, I think the boy considers it irreplaceable. I'm not asking for personal information. In fact, I'm not asking for anything at all. I just want you to return the figure to the mother if she's staying here. I'd be happy to compensate you for your trouble." Jack withdrew a $20 bill from his pocket and set it next to the action figure. The man stared at the action figure and then Jack for a long moment before coming to a decision. "As I said before," the man said, clasping his hands behind his back as he took a step away from both the figurine and Jack's money, "we can't discuss our guests. But I can tell you that a woman and child just headed out to the beach. If you hurry, you can probably catch them." "Tora," Jack said, grabbing both the bill and the action figure. "I appreciate it." "There's nothing to appreciate, sir." Jack nodded his thanks and headed for the doors on the far side of the lobby. Once again, Ding was right. A little human-to-human interaction trumped technology every time. Chapter 19. Jack stepped from the lobby onto the beach and once again regretted his decision to adhere to Tal's ultimatum. A warm breeze smelling of salt, grilling meat,
and faintly a fish slapped Jack in the face while surf lapped against the white sand less than 100 yards away. Jack crossed over a 2-lane biking and running trail, dodging a pair of joggers traveling in one direction and a brunette wearing roller skates and little else heading in the other. Rather than give in to the seductive embrace of jet-lag-induced sleep, Jack had found this same jogging path on his first morning in Israel. He'd followed it along the ocean from Jaffa all the way north to the Tel Aviv marina. The trail really was a feat of engineering, plodding past stretches of open beach interspersed with nightclubs, restaurants, volleyball courts, cafes, and high-end boutique shops. Every couple of kilometers, permanent exercise equipment sprouted from the sand, fashioned out of steel and coated thick with paint to resist the corrosive salt water. But this time it wasn't beauties sunbathing, pedestrians ambling along the path, or even the ocean's whispering that caught Jack's attention. It was the sight of a mother and child standing in the ankle-deep surf to his right. He'd found them. Jack thought of calling out, but didn't. Between the dozens of conversations in half as many languages and the gusting wind, the chances of his words reaching their target were slim. Besides, even if she heard him, Jack didn't know how the woman would react. Last time she'd seen him, Jack had been in the fight of his life with an Asian assassin. Even though he'd been protecting her at the time, he couldn't help but think his presence now might be a wee bit of a shock. No, Jack would approach, surrender the toy, and bid her farewell. Then it was back to Ben-Gurion Airport and a flight to somewhere else. Jack let his mind drift for the moment as he considered where that flight to somewhere else might take him. God knew that he had more than his share of vacation time coming after the non-stop up-tempo of the last few years, and the idea of spending some time on a surfboard had really taken hold. What if instead of flying west, he headed south or southeast? He was already halfway around the world. Maybe it was time to finally take that trip to South Africa, or Australia, or New Zealand. Jack paused, turning his face to the sun as he closed his eyes, breathing in the salty air. Though his father now spent his time surrounded by armed men and women while working out of the world's most exclusive office, there was a time when Jack Ryan Sr. could walk the streets unrecognized, when the work he did as a CIA analyst was known to but a select few, long before he'd entered the high-profile world of national politics. In those days, Junior remembered hiking a length of the Appalachian Trail with his father. The section they'd chosen wound through the mountains of Dahlonega, Georgia, not far from where the Army's legendary Ranger School taught its pupils the finer points of mountaineering. On day 3 of their hike, father and son came to a break in the canopy, permitting an unobstructed view into the valley below. Jack was about 15 at the time and was walking point. He'd come across the gap in the trees first, indicating the breathtaking vista to his father before continuing up the steep incline. The straps of his pack bit into his still widening shoulders, and he'd hunched forward into the load, not realizing that his father wasn't with him until he'd hiked another 50 meters. Backtracking, Jack had found Senior standing motionless, still contemplating the view, sensing that something magical was happening. Jack had silently joined his father. After a moment, Senior had draped a rugged arm across Junior. "I appreciate the majesty of God's creation more the older I get," Senior said, still captivated by the view. "Don't get me wrong. I've always enjoyed being outside. But there's something about places like this that resonate with a man's soul. We were created to experience wonder, Jack. But to find it, you have to be willing to look." At 15,
Jack had little reference for what his father had been trying to communicate. But by 30, he'd begun to understand. Whether it was a wife and a family, or a day spent bobbing in the ocean's embrace, there had to be more to life than kicking down doors and chasing bad guys. As his dad had been trying to tell him on the side of a mountain long ago, every job, no matter how noble, was still just a means to an end. Jack was beginning to think that he'd spent far too long focusing on the means, to the detriment of the end. That needed to change. Opening his eyes, Jack greeted the world with a smile. A smile that lasted for just a fraction of a second. He might have taken the first step toward reconciling his professional life with his personal, but the scale was far from balanced. 50 meters away, a mother and child splashed in the surf. But unlike the pastoral scene Jack had just relived, the little boy was going to have a completely different memory. Angling toward the pair, like a wolf culling its prey from the herd, was the Asian man. And this time, he had a gun.
Chapter 20. Spotting a concealed pistol, much like carrying one, was an art form. To most people frequenting the Tel Aviv beach, the Asian man's intent wasn't quite as easy to deduce. But Jack was not most people. Sure, the assassin was bearing down on a woman and child without the easy smile worn by most of the sunbathers. But frowning certainly wasn't a crime. Then there was his dress. While the majority of the beachgoers were in either swimwear or athletic clothing, the man's attire was decidedly less festive. His short-sleeved button-down shirt, cargo pants, and hiking boots definitely looked like they belonged on the boardwalk rather than the beach. But again, this was not necessarily a red flag. The breeze blowing off the ocean fractured into countless swirling eddies, gusting past the rows of lifeguard stands, shops and shelters lining the sand. Boardwalk strollers frequently darted across the no-man's land between sand and concrete, chasing errant papers or napkins, torn from their grasp by the teasing wind. But there was another, more serious tell that set the Asian apart from everyone else. The way he walked, or more specifically, the way he walked carrying a rolled-up windbreaker in his left hand. Rather than allowing the garment to pendulum back and forth with his natural stride, the jacket and the hand holding it hovered in place along the length of his left thigh, because the jacket concealed the gun. For the second time in less than 8 hours, Jack's fingers longed for the comforting grip of the Glock 43 he usually carried. He'd entered Israel clean since this was a non-campus sanctioned operation. Strangely enough, the Asian man didn't seem to care about Israel's restrictive gun control laws. Imagine that. Even as Jack vowed to never leave home without his pistol again, he was already spinning through scenarios. A hit in a public place was more the operandi of a suicide bomber than a skillful assassin. Only someone incredibly foolish or exceedingly desperate would attempt to murder another human being in front of 50 eyewitnesses. While Jack couldn't speak to the Asian man's mindset, he did know from their previous tangle that the assassin was not a threat to be taken lightly. Though Jack had kept the knife man from the woman, the fight had been far from even. That he had sustained only superficial wounds could be attributed more to the assassin's surprise than to Jack's skill. The longer the altercation had continued, the more lopsided it had become. If the Shin Bet officers hadn't intervened when they did, Jack's wounds would have been much more extensive, perhaps even fatal. The assassin was not a simple thug and wouldn't employ his pistol with a spray-and-pray mentality. He was surgical, precise. And since he'd melted back into the crowd of bystanders after the appearance of the Shin Bet officers, he was probably also without a suicide bomber's desire to accompany his victim into the afterlife. This meant that if the man planned on dispatching the mother in broad daylight, his method of killing her would be no less exacting.
His pistol would be compact, perhaps even disguised to look like something else, and definitely suppressed. This necessitated small-caliber bullets and subsonic loads. But this stealth came with a price. The pistol's range. The gunman would have to close to almost contact shot distance to ensure a mortal wound. Since a good 30 meters still separated the assassin and his target, Jack had time. But not much. While he was all in favor of grounding the man with a flying tackle and then duking it out, this time Jack decided to use the part of his anatomy that separated him from his cave-dwelling ancestors, his cerebral cortex. The Asian assassin had already proven to be a skilled combatant. The last thing Jack wanted to do was confront the man barehanded. This was a time to be smart rather than tough. But a crowded Israeli beach didn't offer much in the way of weapons. At the thought of his location, Jack turned, scanning the crowd.